by tiny packs of gum. Old women sit on sidewalks and extend their weathered hands, seeking a coin or two. Avenida Guerrero is thick with police. For Enrique, a Central American without papers, it is treacherous ground. But he is desperate. His friend leans on his arm, drags a foot, and pretends to be lame. They approach every tourist they see. "Want me to show you where the train hit me?" the friend offers. Slowly, he lifts his cuff. People recoil. "No, no, here." They give a peso and scurry away. Enrique and his friend quickly lose their nerve. They retreat to the river before the police can catch them, with only enough to buy more crackers. A friend at camp lends him a bucket. He trudges back out to the car wash across from the taco stand. He sits on the bucket. Carefully, he pulls up his T-shirt. There, in an arch just above his belly button, is his tattoo, painfully raw. Enrique Lourdes. Now the words mock him. For the first time, he is ready to go back home. But he holds back his tears and lowers his shirt. He refuses to give up. The moment. He considers crossing the Rio Grande by himself, but his friends at camp warn him against it. They tell him the trek is treacherous from the moment you step into the river. A month ago, one of the camp dwellers saw a man's body float past. It was bloated. Sometimes friends say migrants are killed when whirlpools suck them under. Other times whirlpools smash their heads against rocks. Sometimes their legs cramp and they sink. Other times INS helicopters fly too low, whip up waves, and swamp inner tubes, riders, and all. They call the helicopters mosquitoes. They come down and bite. Migrants at the car wash tell him about the trains. 8 to 10 leave for El Norte every day. Security guards stand on a platform over the freight cars, watch for migrants, and pull them off before they cross the bridge. As soon as the trains reach the U.S. side, the cars are inspected again. Then at Mila 12, the first INS checkpoint north of Laredo, the trains stop inside a fence. It is impossible to run. Agents scan the cars with an infrared telescope to pick up body heat. And then come the dogs. The INS uses them at its second checkpoint, some 80 miles north near Catula. The trains carry new Fords and Chryslers. Migrants like to hide in the cars or among them, and the dogs sniff them out. One of the dogs is a Malinois, imported from Belgium for her keen ability to smell human sweat and saliva, even from outside closed cars with their windows rolled up. Her name is Franca. She takes commands in German. Immigrants smear themselves with garlic to throw her off. She begins upwind of the train and runs alongside its length, straining at the leash until she gets a hit. She jumps up and down when she suspects that they are there, and she rarely misses. Agents open and inspect the double-decker boxcars. 10-4, we have bodies up here, they announce. Agents praise the dog and let her play with a rubber toy. Enrique decides that walking across Texas is out. Without a guide, his campmates say, it is easy to get lost and wander in circles in the sameness of the brushlands. The trek to San Antonio takes 7 or 8 days, in desert heat of up to 120 degrees, with diamondback rattlers, lacerating cactus needles, water slimy with cattle spit, saucer-sized tarantulas, and wild hogs with tusks. Some migrants, dehydrated and delirious, kill themselves. Their leathery corpses sway from belts around their necks, on whatever is sturdy and tall. Water jugs lie empty at their feet. Some are shot by ranchers as they try to beg or steal food or drink. A few weeks after Enrique arrived in Nuevo Laredo, Mexican immigrant Eusebio de Aro Espinosa, 23, went up to a rancher in Brackettville, Texas, 40 miles from the border, and asked for water. The rancher, Samuel Blackwood, 75, shot him in the leg with a .357 Magnum. He didn't seek medical help. Espinosa bled to death. Texas ranchers have become increasingly riled by immigrants who trespass. There are two kinds of wets, says retired trucker Jake Smith, who lives in a trailer on a ramshackle ranch in Martinez near Cotulla, Texas. Good wets and bad wets. When immigrants are near, the dogs bark. Smith sits on the front porch with a pistol in his lap. Bad immigrants pack drugs, break into your place, and steal things, he says. Even the good ones, who are in search of honest work, leave the gates open, let the cattle out, or break into your place looking for food and water, says Smith, a crusty white-haired man who occasionally gets his glass eye cleaned by a nearby large animal veterinarian. Ranch owner Joe Crisp has installed 3 locks on each window of his home. Immigrants have broken in 8 times. Once they rammed a hole in his wall to get inside. Another time they broke through the roof. Such intrusions are so common that Border Patrol agents advise ranchers to leave water and food outside beside their doors. Every rancher near the Crisp and Smith homes has heard about the incident when a rancher turned down an immigrant who asked to use his telephone. The immigrant tied the rancher to a chair and stole his pickup truck. Some of Enrique's campmates say they were apprehended when a rancher pointed a pistol at them, told them to freeze, and then dialed the U.S. immigration agents on his cell phone. Many migrants trying to enter are caught by the INS. 108,973 near Laredo in 2000, the year Enrique is trying. Enrique will have to outsmart Border Patrol agents on the other side who are skilled and dogged. Tracker Charles Grout can spot a footprint from a moving Ford Bronco. His partner, Manuel Sauceda, can tell within a range of a few hours how old it is. They are agents for the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service based in Cotulla, halfway along a 7 to 8 day walk between the Rio Grande at Nuevo Laredo and San Antonio. Their job is to arrest immigrants who enter Texas illegally. Salary increases for Grout and Sauceda are based partly on how many migrants they catch. They work together along railroads and in the desert, taking turns tracking on foot and driving ahead in the Bronco, sometimes for days. One Thursday in September 2000, Sauceda discovers footprints near a cattle trough southwest of Ensenal. He knows immigrants drink from the trough, although the water smells like rotten eggs and is laced with green scum. He circles the footprints and draws closer. If footprints are not windblown or caved in, they are recent. If no animals, such as centipedes, snails, birds, or snakes, have crossed them, they are fresh. If there are discarded food wrappers nearby, and if the wrappers are not covered with ants, the tracks are brand new. Sauceda circles the water trough, sweat trickling down his face, searching among piles of cow manure for clues. He faces the sun and looks for tiny shadows. Then he finds more tracks. They have been made that morning. He detects patterns. One track is waffled, another has fine lines, and another is shaped like the pointed toe of a boot. "I see at least 4 here," he says. He smiles. Like a bloodhound, he leans over and picks up his pace. Changes at the Cotulla office show how much harder it has become to sneak past agents like Grout and Sauceda. In 1994, Cotulla had 20 agents. Now, in Cotulla alone, Enrique will face 70 agents. Cotulla is one of 8 INS stations north of Nuevo Laredo. In all, the INS has hired more than 5,600 additional agents since 1993 to expand its forces along the southern U.S. border. In addition, agents use a growing arsenal of technology. Helicopters, night vision goggles, thermal imaging that picks up body heat, and seismic sensors that detect footsteps along immigrant trails. One INS officer's only job is to move the sensors to outsmart smugglers who try to plot their locations. Earlier on this day, alerted by Sensor 53, agents caught 11 Mexican men who had been walking across the desert for 4 days. Grout and Sauceda are particularly dogged, partly because it means saving lives. Every 2 weeks or so, Sauceda says he has to call an ambulance for an immigrant who has been bitten by a rattlesnake, or hit by a train, or has grown so dehydrated in the Texas desert that he is nearing collapse. Sauceda follows the footprints at the water trough. He comes to a trail, climbs into the Bronco, and drives, opening and closing gates with keys from a ring that holds scores given to the agents by ranchers. The temperature climbs to 100 degrees, cool compared with the highs of 112 to 118 the week before, which had partially melted the asphalt on Interstate 35. The Bronco has a rangefire prevention reminder on the dashboard. Do not operate off the road in dry grass or brush. Sauceda ignores it. By 2 p.m., Grout and Sauceda have lost and found the track several times. Whoever is leaving them seems to be angling toward a tower with an antenna. The two trackers search every big tree and water source. They come to a barbed wire fence. Marks in the dirt show that their quarry has crawled under it. Grout picks up the tracks on the other side. "There they are, the same ones," he says. "Bigger than Dallas." The track makers are headed for Ensenau. If they reach town, it will be virtually impossible to find them, and the agents' half-day spent in the cactus and the searing heat will be wasted. Sauceda, dripping sweat, trots alongside the footprints. Grout drives ahead to the edge of town. He spots an odd-looking dirt driveway. The right side has been dragged clean. It leads to a ramshackle house. He parks. There in soil leading to the driveway are the footprints. Waffle, fine lines, the point of a boot. "I got 'em," he says into a walkie-talkie. "Where?" Sauceda asks. "Same place as the last time." Grout takes 3 paces toward the house. A Rottweiler lunges from behind a tree. Grout reaches for his .40-caliber Beretta. A chain stops the dog a few feet in front of him. Carefully, Grout presses forward 7 more paces, then swings open the door to a yellow shed. Jammed inside are 5 surprised immigrants. He handcuffs them. Back at the Bronco, he inspects their footwear. Waffle, fine lines, pointed boot. He smiles. Many immigrants are glad to be tracked down. Isaias Guerra from Veracruz, Mexico, looked relieved when Grout found him. Guerra had been lost in the wilderness for 2 days. He had survived by eating cactus. The first day, 5 coyotes had followed him. The animals got so close that Guerra hit 2 of them with a stick to force them to back off. That night he slept in a tree. The next day a large mound 12 feet away from him that at first looked like cow dung started moving. A rattlesnake, coiled as thick as his upper arm, prepared to strike. He saw 3 more snakes. At dusk he spotted a bobcat nearby. He quietly backed away. Guerra gladly crawled into the back of Grout's truck, dubbed the cage. Migrants deported by the United States often return to the San Jose Church. Enrique sees some of them. A tall man arrives at the church one evening with a vacant, dull look in his eyes. He hasn't eaten in 5 days. His brown shirt hangs in pieces on his body, torn to shreds by the cactus. His arms are cut up and bleeding, pinpricked with thistles and thorns. He is caked in mud. The bottoms of both feet are covered by gargantuan yellow blisters. His toes are swollen like sausages. The nails have turned black. He stumbles forward on his heels, barely able to walk. He's done 70 miles in the past 6 days, killing 5 rattlers along the way. He begs for a glass of water and a shower. Everything Enrique hears makes him terrified of snakes and scorpions. In the Texas desert, snakes come out to hunt at night, when it is cooler. That is when migrants are on the move. They fumble forward in the dark, afraid to use a flashlight. Some rely instead on superstitions. Take a pregnant woman with you, and the snakes will sleep as you pass by. Put 3 peppercorns under your tongue for good luck. There are copperhead snakes, coral snakes, cottonmouth snakes, and the blue indigo snake, so long and fast it can kill a rattlesnake. There is a bumper crop this year, and the drought has made them more aggressive. Many times when Enrique falls asleep, he has the same nightmare. A snake has bitten him in the mouth. He cannot call out for help. El Hongo listens. Finally, he decides against going alone. Why should I die doing this? He asks himself. Somehow he will call his mother and ask her to hire a smuggler. 9 rings of coyotes are said to operate in Nuevo Laredo. Each ring has at least 50 smugglers. But Enrique knows he cannot trust just anyone. Back home in Honduras, most smugglers are honest. They must uphold their reputations if they want business. Here they can rob, rape, or abandon their clients with impunity. Some take them straight to river bandits and get a cut. Only 1 smuggler in 10, says a nun, at the Parroquia de San Jose, is trustworthy. Many migrants at the church return with smuggler horror stories. Enrique has spent a lot of time around El Tarindaro. Enrique has seen him take a number of men and boys across the river, always at night, usually 1 or 2 at a time, paddling furiously in their inner tubes. They always disappear into the United States. When El Tarindaro takes them over, Enrique notices they are never caught and sent back. El Tarindaro has studied the movements of the Border Patrol so long, says fellow patero Juan Baraja Soto, that he knows what each agent does every 8 hours during the shift change. Enrique makes a decision. When he calls his mother, he will ask her to hire El Tarindaro. I know, he says to himself, that he won't strand me. On May 18th, he awakens to find that someone has stolen his right shoe. Shoes are almost as important as food and his mother's telephone number. He can think of every pair that has helped him come north. On this trip alone, there were 7. Blue shoes, white shoes, leather work boots, Nike sneakers. He has bought, borrowed, or traded for them. All have fallen apart or been stolen. But never only 1. He spots a sneaker floating near the riverbank. He snags it. It is for a left foot. Now he has 2 left shoes. Bucket in hand, he hobbles back to the taco stand, begging along the way. People give him a peso or 2. He washes a few cars, and it starts to rain. Astonishingly, he has put together 20 pesos in all. That is enough to trade in his 30-peso phone card for 1 worth 50 pesos. He will use the 50-peso card to call his old boss at the tire store. If the boss reaches his aunt and uncle, if they know his mother's number, if his aunt or uncle will call him back. Padre Leo's help. It is May 19th. There is only 1 way his plan will work. Father Leonardo Lopez Guajardo, at the Parroquia de San Jose, is known to let migrants phone from the church if they have cards. Each day he serves as their telephone assistant. In flip-flops, he pads to the door every 15 minutes or so and summons someone for a return call. Enrique will have to trust the priest to find him if his aunt and uncle call back. He has already sensed what people in Nuevo Laredo know. When it comes to migrants, Padre Leo's heart is bigger than his collections. The priest rarely uses his office. Most afternoons and evenings he sits by the door, behind a small wooden desk in a room that doubles as a food pantry. The room is lined with shelves stocked with cans and boxes of food, donations to help feed migrants. There is a pile of overripe fruits and vegetables on the floor. Flies buzz around it. It stinks of rotting tomatoes and onions. Liquid has seeped from the decomposing vegetables and pooled on the floor. Here, one by one, he attends to a stream of migrants. Padre Leo takes down the migrants' information, then gives them a meal card or arranges to pick up money wired by relatives in the United States. In Nuevo Laredo, Padre Leo is not a typical priest. When he was a boy, even his mother questioned whether he was priest material. So did his teachers at the seminary, who deemed him too playful and impatient with pomp and procedure. They delayed his ordination. It took him 11 years to graduate. Other priests in town wear nice watches and rings and act important. Padre Leo is so disheveled that visitors sometimes mistake him for one of the poor, dirty migrants sitting outside. His clothes are always rumpled. He wears the same pants for days, stained and dirty from hauling boxes of ripe vegetables. His favorite pair has frayed cuffs and a small tear in the rear. He forgets to zip them up. The men in the congregation try to help. They point at his fly. "Ah, ah, see, see, see," the priest says, hastily pulling the zipper into place. Padre Leo emerges one night from his bedroom to say Mass. His flannel shirt is inside out and buttoned incorrectly. The church's other priest looks exasperated. "Where's your belt?" he asks. Leo shuffles back to his bedroom to take another stab at dressing himself. The only time he looks neat is when he visits his family. His mother sends him back to Nuevo Laredo perfumed with cologne and in a newly pressed shirt and pants. Priests in town favor the latest model Grand Marquis. Padre Leo rides everywhere on a rickety blue bicycle. People call him El Papa en la Bici. He rides when it is cold, hot, raining. When he goes to other churches to say Mass, he carries his white floor-length robe in a small bag across the handlebars. In the evenings, Enrique watches the priest return to the church on his bicycle, loaded down with bags of donated bread. During Mass, he doesn't read from the Bible much. He conveys his message through jokes or by spinning a lesson out of a popular movie or song. He does not stand at the altar. He paces up and down the church aisle's pink floors in his white robe, which he wears with broken-down tennis shoes. As he paces, he mops copious quantities of sweat from his balding head with a large white towel. A microphone in his left hand, the towel in his right, he preaches. Like most in his church, Secretary Alma Delia Jimenez, Renteria, says she has learned more from what the priest practices than what he preaches. In 1997, when she was new in her job at the church, the future mayor of the city, Horacio Garza, came to visit Padre Leo. A foul-smelling migrant with badly swollen feet also needed to talk to the priest. Alma asked the migrant to wait and started to usher in the future mayor. The priest stopped her. "No, let the mayor wait. Let the person who is most in need see me first," he said. Says Alma, "He isn't a padre who tells you what to do. He shows you through his actions, through his example. He doesn't pray with rosary or Bible. He loves God by doing good toward others. That's how he teaches you to love God. He is impatient to get things done, tackling too many things at once. He rarely sits down for a meal, living off a chunk of chocolate in one hand, a bit of bread in the other. He scoops some rice or beans out of buckets of food left in the pantry, or eats from a can of food he plucks off the shelves. He cannot sit or stand still. Often, in mid-confession, his mind wanders to the next thing he must do for migrants. Disculpe, ahorita vuelvo. Pardon me, I'll be right back, he tells people. Usually, just as they are opening up. He is unfailingly polite, even formal. But he can be awkward, even curt, around people. When someone gives the church money, he responds with a simple, "Ah, bien." When he walks down the street, he is so distracted he often fails to say hello, when he passes a church member. It took the arrival of two nuns in 1998 to bring some order and rules to the padre's operations. He is humble and lives modestly. He gives his salary to the church to help it pay staff salaries. When someone gave him a nice truck, he sold it to pay church utility bills. His car, which he rarely drives to save gas and help the environment, is a tiny Mazda purchased for $400. The driver's door won't open from the outside. The vinyl dash is shredded, and the front seat has a huge hole in it. His focus is one instilled by mentors at the seminary. Either we are with the poor or we are not. God teaches us to most help the poor. Any other interpretation is unacceptable. To Padre Leo, the people most in need in Nuevo Laredo are migrants. They go for days without food, for months without resting their heads on a pillow. They are defenseless against an onslaught of abuses. He vowed to restore a bit of their dignity. He saw that these people are the most vulnerable, the most disliked by the local population. So he gave himself to them, says a church volunteer, Pedro Leiva. He tells church members that they too were once migrants. Saint Joseph was a migrant. The Bible was written by migrants. Running off a migrant, he says, is like turning against yourself. A person must be more than spiritual, he tells them. They must act. Some people read the Bible and fall asleep, says Padre Leo. For me, it was a jolt. The worst thing as a Christian is to go through life asleep. People knew he was special from the day he arrived. A bus and caravan of cars, 60 people, journeyed with him from his old church in Anahuac to Nuevo Laredo to say farewell through tears. The priest knocked on every door in the neighborhood. Good afternoon, my name is Leonardo. I'm the new priest. I'm here to serve you, he said. In a country where the church is conservative, Padre Leo announced in a newspaper article shortly after arriving, Jesus wasn't killed for doing miracles. It was because he defended the poor and opposed the rulers and the injustice committed by the powerful. Padre Leo gave up the two-bedroom priest's apartment attached to the church so that female migrants would have a place to sleep. He settled into a tiny room off the pantry, into which a narrow bed and chest of drawers just fit. His bathroom, the church's public restroom. To help the migrants look more presentable, he brings a haircutter to the church. A doctor treats their illnesses for free. If they need blood, Padre Leo is the first to donate. To clothe the migrants, he circumvents Mexican customs, which inspects cars and confiscates used clothing coming into the country, in what Padre Leo believes is an attempt to protect Mexican clothing manufacturers. People crossing the border checkpoint on foot or on a bike are less likely to be inspected. Twice a week at dusk, Padre Leo grabs a large black duffel bag and pedals his bike over a bridge that spans the Rio Grande into Laredo, Texas. There he buys used clothes for 20 cents a pound. With one strap hooked around each arm, he carries the bag stuffed with clothes across his back and balances another bag across the handlebars. In the gathering dark, he pedals back. If the church stash is low or lacks a needed size, he gives away the few shoes and clothes he owns. Sometimes he slips the shoes off his feet and hands them to a migrant. Padre, I don't have a shirt, a migrant says. The priest runs to his closet and pulls one out. These clothes are usually the shirts, pants, shoes, and jackets the members of the church's 8 study groups have given the priest for his birthday, to tide him over for the year. You give it to him, he admires it, then he gives it away, says Pedro Leiva. To feed migrants, often more than 100 each night, he collects food 3 days a week from stores in Nuevo Laredo. On Mondays and Wednesdays, he drives the church van to Laredo. At a Catholic orphanage, he hauls out leftover boxes of honeydew melon, oranges, and bread. Then he goes to a house at the end of a cul-de-sac. Rosalinda Zapata's husband works at the HEB supermarket. Her hallway is lined with boxes of recently expired crackers, salsa, and potato chips. Padre Leo heads back to Mexico with the food. As he crosses the long bridge over the Rio Grande, he begins to pray. At the Mexican side of the bridge, 1 in 10 cars gets a red light and is pulled over for a random inspection. God, please give me a green light. Please. I promise I'll be good. He tells God he doesn't want to haul contraband, but it's the only way to help the migrants. The light flashes green. He smiles and steps on the gas. Back at the church, he shows off his haul. Excelente! Qué bueno fue el arriesque! Excellent. The risk was so worth it. He is as gleeful as a child who has gotten away with something forbidden. He is happiest when the pantry is full and there is plenty to give away. He is the migrant's strongest advocate in Nuevo Laredo. Each September, he leads a silent procession of people who place a cross on a fence overlooking the Rio Grande, one for each migrant who has recently died trying to cross into the United States. He finds friends who can help identify migrants who drown in the river, so their families can be contacted and their bodies shipped home. In November, after saying Mass in the middle of the cemetery for the Day of the Dead, he leads a crowd over to a common grave in the corner of the cemetery. He leads a prayer for dead migrants who are buried here. This is a sad place, God. We want to remember the migrants who passed this way. To be their champion, he has gone against the initial wishes of many in his church and faced threats from the authorities, much like priest Salomon Lemus Lemus in Veracruz, where 1 in 2 congregants quit the church in protest at letting migrants use the parish as a dormitory. Half of Padre Leo's church members at first opposed the priest's mission to help migrants, says one church volunteer, Patricia Alemán Peña. Some thought the priest was crazy to attract what they saw as bums and delinquents to their neighborhood, and objected to helping migrants at all. This was a good neighborhood until you brought your people, they complained. Others urged him to give them a taco, but for God's sake not to allow illegals into the church. What if among the Central Americans there were dangerous criminals fleeing prosecution in their own countries? Why not let a church with more resources take on this task? Why, others asked, should all their tithes go to helping strangers to the extent of building a room to feed them supper? Meanwhile, their church, one of the poorest of the city, was falling apart. The pews were decrepit. The bills were once so in arrears the electricity was nearly turned off. And the padre hadn't installed air conditioning, despite summer temperatures that reach 120 degrees. A church survey showed that many didn't attend church because of the migrants. Only a tenth of the neighborhood's residents come to the Parroquia de San Jose. In other neighborhoods, a quarter attend Mass. Neighbors confronted the priest. Migrants would loiter, drink, and smoke around the church. They feel like peeing, and they just let loose, and urinate on her front gate, says a woman who lives next to the church. Another neighbor says a migrant hugged and tried to kiss one of her twin daughters. The migrants sleep around the church, get into fights, and defecate on her doorstep. She has to scrub the sidewalk with bleach to get rid of the stench. Many priests and the bishop admire and support Padre Leo. Others oppose him. Priests, they say, should stick to doing Mass, weddings, and baptisms. The social role of helping the poor and migrants belongs to politicians. Some snicker that he's a clown, laugh about his appearance, dismiss his humility as an act. Once, the local director of La Migra threatened to lock up the priest for several years on smuggling charges if he didn't bar migrants from entering his church. Leo promised to behave, and then ignored the warning. Now 3/4 of the people in his parish agree with his work. We should say thanks that we don't have to go through this. but maybe with a bit of bread, a smile, you can lessen their load, says Peña. Without the church's help, she says, the migrants would be even more desperate and the impact on the city would be worse. Like many others at the church, she volunteers to help cook dinner for the migrants each day. There is no one like this man. He is too humble, she says of her priest. Padre Leo has taught me to give to others without expecting anything in return. In late afternoon, Enrique reaches his old boss on the church telephone with his request. 2 hours later, the padre bellows Enrique's name. As always, word spreads through the courtyard like wildfire. Someone named Enrique has a phone call. Are you all right? Asks Uncle Carlos. Yes, I'm okay. I want to call my mom. I've lost the phone number. Somehow, his boss has neglected to tell them this. Do they have it with them? Aunt Rosa Amalia fumbles in her purse. She finds the number. Uncle Carlos reads it, digit by digit, into the phone. 10 digits. Carefully, Enrique writes them down, one after another on a shred of paper. Just as Uncle Carlos finishes, the phone dies. Uncle Carlos calls again, but Enrique is already gone. He cannot wait. When he talks to his mom, he wants to be alone. He might cry. He runs to an out-of-the-way payphone to call her, collect. He is nervous. Maybe she is sharing a place with unrelated immigrants, and they have blocked the telephone to collect calls. Or she might refuse to pay. It has been 11 years. She does not even know him. She told him harshly not to come north, but he disobeyed her. Each of the few times they talked, she urged him to study. This, after all, was why she left, to send money for school. But he has dropped out of school. Heart in his throat, he stands on the edge of a small park, 2 blocks from the camp. Next to the grass is a Telmex phone box on a pole. It is 7 p.m. and dangerous. Police patrol the park. Enrique, a slight youngster with 2 left shoes, pulls the shred of paper from his jeans. They are worn and torn. He is too tattered to be in this neighborhood. He reaches for the receiver. His T-shirt is blazing white, sure to attract attention. Slowly, carefully, he unfolds his prized possession, her phone number. He listens in wonderment as his mother answers. She accepts the charges. Mommy? At the other end, Lourdes's hands begin to tremble, then her arms and knees. Hola, mi hijo! Hello, my son. Where are you? I'm in Nuevo Laredo. ¿A dónde está? Where are you? I was so worried. Her voice breaks, but she forces herself not to cry, lest she cause him to break down too. North Carolina, she explains where that is. Enrique's foreboding eases. How are you coming? Get a coyote. She sounds worried. She knows of a good smuggler in Piedras Negras. No, no, he says. I have someone here. Enrique trusts El Tarindaro, but he costs $1,200. She will get the money together. Be careful, she says. The conversation is awkward. His mother is a stranger. This is probably expensive. He knows that collect calls to the United States from back home in Honduras cost several dollars a minute. But he can feel her love. He places the receiver in its cradle and sighs. At the other end, his mother finally cries. 6. A dark river, perhaps a new life. At 1 a.m. on May 21st, 2000, Enrique waits on the edge of the water. If you get caught, I don't know you, says El Tarindaro. He is stern. Enrique nods. So do 2 other migrants, a Mexican brother and sister, waiting with him. They strip to their underwear. Enrique has seen smugglers ask migrants to grab hold of a long rope to cross the river. Others lock arms and form a human chain. El Torindaro's strategy is more risky. He uses a black inner tube, which is bulky and easy for border patrol agents to spot. Across the Rio Grande stands a 50-foot pole equipped with U.S. Border Patrol cameras. In daylight, Enrique has counted 4 sport utility vehicles near the pole, each with agents. Now in the darkness, he cannot see any. He leaves it up to El Torindaro, who has spent hours at this spot studying everything that moves on the other side. Enrique tears up a small piece of paper and scatters it on the riverbank. It is his mother's phone number. He has memorized it. Now the agents cannot use it to locate and deport her. In all, Enrique has spent 4 months trying to find her. El Torindaro holds an inner tube. The Mexicans climb on. He paddles them to an island in midstream. He returns for Enrique with the tube. He steadies it in the water. Carefully, Enrique climbs aboard. Up to 3 migrants have drowned in a single day along this stretch of river. The Rio Bravo, as it is called here, is swollen with rain, a torrent of water coursing toward the Gulf of Mexico. 2 nights ago it killed a youngster he knew, a tall, skinny migrant with a cleft upper lip. A whirlpool pulled him under. The year is not yet half over. Already 54 people have been pulled, lifeless, from the river at or near Nuevo Laredo. Enrique cannot swim, and he is afraid. El Torindaro places a plastic garbage bag on Enrique's lap. It contains dry clothing for the 4 of them. Then El Torindaro paddles and starts to push. A swift current grabs the tube and sweeps it into the river. Wind whips off Enrique's cap. Drizzle coats his face. He dips in a hand. The water is cold. He scans the murky water for the green snakes that sometimes skim across the waves. All at once he sees a flash of white, one of the SUVs, probably with a dog in back, inching along a trail above the river. Silence. No bullhorn barks. Turn back. The inner tube lurches, sloshes, and bounces along. Enrique grips the valve stem. The sky is overcast, and the river is dark. In the distance, bits of light dance on the surface. At last, he sees the island, overgrown with willows and reeds. He seizes the limb of a willow. It tears off. With both hands, he lays hold of a larger branch, and the inner tube swings onto the silt and grass. They have crossed the southern channel. On the other side of the island flows the northern channel, even more frightening because it is closer to the United States. El Torindaro circles the island on foot and looks across the water. The white SUV reappears less than 100 yards away. It is moving slowly along the dirt trail high on the riverbank. Its roof lights flash red and blue on the water, creating a psychedelic sheen. Agents turn to aim a spotlight straight at the island. Enrique and the Mexicans dive to the ground face first. If the agents spot them and lie in wait, it could spell doom for Enrique. He is closer to his mother than ever. Authorities can deport the Mexicans back across the river, but they can send him all the way to Honduras. Worse, he could sit in a Texas jail cell for months before the United States processed the paperwork to deport him. Most likely the juvenile prison in Liberty, Texas, 46 miles northeast of Houston, where many minors who are captured in Texas, trying to enter the United States alone and illegally, are sent to await deportation. Immigrant children arrive at the jail shackled. They are strip-searched and asked to squat and cough, an exercise to determine if they are harboring any contraband items in certain cavities of their bodies. They file through 8 locked metal doors to arrive at the E-pod, where immigrant children as young as 12 are held. They are housed at times in the same pod with accused rapists and other felons. Children in the EPOD spend most of their time inside windowless cells that measure 7.5 by 10 feet. Migrant children say the jail, operated by Corrections Corporation of America, doesn't feed them enough. Without cash to buy from the jail's commissary, they go hungry and lose weight. They see sunlight 1 hour a day when they are allowed into an outdoor area surrounded by a fence topped with concertina wire. They have little information about when they might be brought before an immigration judge or deported. The guards know little, and most do not speak Spanish. Locked up day after day, month after month, the children grow desperate. They run circles around their tiny cells. They read the instructions on the shampoo label over and over. Some become fearful they will go crazy in the jail. They begin to talk to themselves. One boy gets so depressed he stops eating for days and bangs his knuckles against the concrete wall until they are raw. A few of the children become suicidal and try to hang themselves. If he was lucky, Enrique would spend no more than 2 or 3 months locked up before being sent back to Honduras. It would mean starting out for the 9th time. For 30 minutes on the river's island, everyone lies stone still. Crickets sing, and water rushes around the rocks. Finally, the agents seem to give up. El Tirindaro waits and watches. He makes certain, then returns. Enrique whispers, "Take the others first." El Tirindaro loads the Mexicans onto the tube. Their weight sinks it almost out of sight. Slowly, they lumber across the water. Minutes later, El Tirindaro returns. "Get over here," he says to Enrique. "Climb up." He has other instructions. Don't rustle the garbage bag holding the clothes. Don't step on twigs. Don't paddle. It makes noise. El Tirindaro slips into the water behind the tube and kicks his legs beneath the surface. It takes only a minute or two. He and Enrique reach a spot where the river slows, and Enrique grabs another branch. They pull ashore and touch soft, slippery mud. In his underwear, Enrique stands for the first time on U.S. soil. Nearly frozen. As El Tirindaro hides the inner tube, he spots the border patrol. He and the 3 migrants hurry along the edge of the Rio Grande to a tributary called Sacate Creek. "Get in," El Tirindaro says. Enrique walks into the creek. It is cold. He bends his knees and lowers himself to his chin. His broken teeth chatter so hard they hurt. He cups a hand over his mouth, trying to stop them. For 1.5 hours they stand in Sacate Creek in silence. Effluent spills into the water from a 3-foot-wide pipe close by. It is connected to a sewage treatment plant on the edge of Laredo, Texas. Enrique can smell it. El Tirindaro walks ahead, scouting as he goes. At his command, Enrique and the others climb out of the water. Enrique is numb. He falls to the ground, nearly frozen. "Dress quickly," El Tirindaro says. Enrique steps out of his wet undershorts and tosses them away. They are his last possession from home. He puts on dry jeans, a dry shirt, and his 2 left shoes. El Tirindaro offers everyone a piece of bread and a soda. The others, hidden in a thicket of bushes, eat and drink. Enrique is too nervous. Being on the outskirts of Laredo means they are near homes. If dogs bark, the border patrol will suspect intruders. "This is the hard part," El Tirindaro says. He runs. Enrique races behind him. The Mexicans follow up a steep embankment, along a well-worn dirt path, past mesquite bushes and behind some tamarind trees, until they are next to a large, round, flat tank. It is part of the sewage plant. Beyond is an open space. El Tirindaro glances nervously to the right and left. Nothing. "Follow me," he says. Now he runs faster. Numbness washes out of Enrique's legs. It disappears in a wave of fear. They sprint next to a fence, then along a narrow path on a cliff above the creek. They dash down another embankment, into the dry upstream channel of Sakate Creek, under a pipe, then a pedestrian bridge across the channel, up the opposite embankment, and out onto a two-lane residential street. Two cars pass. Winded, the four scuttle into bushes. Half a block ahead, a car flashes its headlights. Puffs of clouds. It is a red Chevrolet Blazer with tinted windows. "Let's go," El Torindero says. As they reach it, locks click open. Enrique and the others scramble inside. In front sit a Latino driver and a woman, part of El Torindero's smuggling network. Enrique has met them before, on the other side of the river. It is 4 a.m. Enrique is exhausted. He climbs onto pillows in back. They are like puffs of clouds, and he feels immense relief. He smiles and says to himself, "Now that I'm in this car, no one can get me out." The engine starts and the driver passes back a pack of beer. He asks Enrique to put it into a cooler. The driver pops a top. For a moment, Enrique worries, what if the driver has too many? The Blazer heads toward Dallas. Border patrol agents pay attention to Blazers, other SUVs, and vans. Some smugglers favor windowless vans. They strip out the back seats and stack the migrants like cordwood, one on top of the other. Headlights tilted up mean there are people in the back, weighing down the vehicle, says Alexander D. Hernandez, a supervisor in Catula, Texas. Weaving means the load is heavy and causing sway. When the agents notice, they pull alongside and shine a flashlight into the eyes of the passengers. If the riders do not look over but seem frozen in their seats, they are likely to be illegal immigrants. Enrique sleeps until El Torindero shakes him. They are out of Laredo and half a mile south of a border patrol checkpoint. "Get up," El Torindero says. Enrique can tell he has been drinking. Five beers are gone. The Blazer stops. Enrique and the two Mexicans, with El Torindero leading, climb a wire fence and walk east, away from the freeway. Then they turn north, parallel to it. Enrique can see the checkpoint at a distance. "Every car must stop. U.S. citizens?" agents ask. Often they check for documents. Enrique and his group walk 10 minutes more, then turn west, back toward the freeway. They crouch next to a billboard. Overhead, the stars are receding, and he can see the first light of dawn. The Blazer pulls up. Enrique sinks back into the pillows. He thinks, "I have crossed the last big hurdle." Suddenly, he is overwhelmed. Never has he felt so happy. He stares at the ceiling and drifts into a deep, blissful sleep. 400 miles later, the Blazer pulls into a gas station on the outskirts of Dallas. Enrique awakens. El Torindero is gone. He has left without saying goodbye. From conversations in Mexico, Enrique knows that El Torindero gets $100 a client. Enrique's mother, Lourdes, has promised $1,200. The driver is the boss. He gets most of the money. The patero is on his way back to Mexico. Along with fuel, the driver buys more beer, and the Blazer rolls into Dallas about noon. America looks beautiful. The buildings are huge. The freeways have traffic exchanges with double and triple decks. They are nothing like the dirt streets at home. Everything is clean. The driver drops off the Mexicans and takes Enrique to a large house. Inside are bags of clothing, in various sizes and American styles, to outfit clients so they no longer stand out. They telephone his mother. Lourdes. Lourdes, now 35 years old, has come to love North Carolina. People are polite. There are plenty of jobs for immigrants, and it seems to be safe. She can leave her car unlocked as well as her house. Her daughter Diana quickly masters English, something she hadn't done surrounded by Spanish speakers in California. Lourdes is always thinking about the two children she left in Honduras. When she walks by stores that sell things they might like, she thinks of Enrique and Belki. When she meets a child Enrique's age, she tells herself, Así debe estar mi muchachito. My little boy must look this big now. A small gray album holds treasures and painful memories. Pictures of Belki, her daughter back home. At 7, Belki wears a white First Communion dress and long white gloves. At 9, a yellow cheerleader's skirt. At 15, for her quinceañera, a pink taffeta dress with lace sleeves and white satin shoes. Belki leans over a two-layer cake topped with white frosting and a pink angel. Lourdes spent $700 to make the party special. She promised Belki she would try to make it back to Honduras for the big event somehow. I wanted to go. I wanted to go, Lourdes says. At 18, Belki wears a blue gown and mortarboard for her high school graduation. There are pictures of Enrique, too. At 8, in a tank top, with 4 piglets at his feet. At 13, in the photograph, at Belki's quinceañera, the serious-looking little brother. She most treasures a photo of her son in a pink shirt. It is the only one she has where he is smiling. She has often worried from afar about her boy. In 1999, a sister in Honduras disclosed the truth about Enrique. He's getting in trouble. He's changed. He was smoking marijuana. The news made Lourdes sick. Her stomach tightened into a knot for a week. Now she is more worried than ever. Lourdes has not slept. All night since Enrique's last call from a payphone across the Rio Grande, she has been having visions of him dead, floating on the river, his body wet and swollen. She told her boyfriend, "My greatest fear is never to see him again." She has spent part of the night in her kitchen, praying before a tall candle adorned with the image of San Judas Tadeo. This saint tackles difficult situations, matters of life and death. Lourdes lit the candle days ago when Enrique made his first phone call from Nuevo Laredo. Each time Lourdes walks past the candle, she prays. God has granted to you the privilege of aiding humankind in the most desperate cases. O come to my aid that I may praise the mercies of God. All my life I will be your grateful client until I can thank you in heaven. Now a female smuggler is on the phone. The woman says, "We have your son in Texas." But $1,200 is not enough. $1,700. Lourdes grows suspicious. Maybe Enrique is dead and the smugglers are trying to cash in. "Put him on the line," she says. "He's out shopping for food," the smuggler replies. Lourdes will not be put off. "He's asleep," the smuggler says. "How can he be both?" Lourdes demands to talk to him. Finally, the smuggler gives the phone to Enrique. "Sos tú?" his mother asks anxiously. "Is it you?" "Sí, mami, it's me." Still, his mother is not sure. She does not recognize his voice. She has heard it only half a dozen times in 11 years. "Sos tú?" she asks again, then twice more. She grasps for something, anything, that she can ask this boy, a question that no one but Enrique can answer. She remembers what he told her about his shoes when he called on the payphone. "What kind of shoes do you have on?" she asks. "Two left shoes," Enrique says. Fear drains from his mother like a wave back into the sea. It is Enrique. She feels pure happiness. Waiting. She takes $500 she has saved, borrows $1,200 from her boyfriend, and wires it to Dallas. In the house with the clothing, the smugglers wait. From the bags, Enrique puts on clean pants, a shirt, and a new pair of shoes. The smugglers take him to a restaurant. He eats chicken smothered in cream sauce. Clean, sated in his mother's adopted country, he is happy. They go to Western Union, but there is no money under his mother's name,